time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
It's just the normal noises in here.
This is Polyphonic Press, the podcast where two music fans pick a classic album completely at random. Using the patented random album generator, they are given an album to review from a curated list of over 1,000 classic releases, spanning multiple genres. And now onto the show. Here are your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke.
All right, hey, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
And let's not waste any time. We've got the patented random album generator right in front of us here. So let's hit the button and see what album we're going to be listening to this week. And the album we're going to be listening to is Grateful Dead, Working Man's Dead.
Okay.
Here's a description of the album. It says, Working Man's Dead, 1970, is one of Grateful Dead's most celebrated and influential albums, marking a sharp turn from their earlier, more experimental psychedelic sound toward a rootsier, song-focused approach. Recorded quickly and on a tight budget after years of heavy touring and debt, the record draws heavily from folk, country, and Americana traditions. Its stripped-down arrangements, warm harmonies, and storytelling lyrics show the band's deepening connection to American roots music and their desire to create something more accessible than their previous sprawling jam. The album features some of the Dead's most enduring songs, including Uncle John's Band, Casey Jones, Dire Wolf, and High Time. These tracks showcase the group's evolving focus on vocal harmonies inspired by contemporaries like Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and narrative songwriting rooted in rural imagery, cautionary tales, and mythical Americana. The shift reflected both a practical need, simpler songs worked better on the road, and an artistic choice, capturing the spirit of early 1970s back to the land culture. Critically, Working Man's Dead was a turning point that brought the band new recognition and commercial success. It helped redefine their identity from a purely psychedelic San Francisco jam band into a cornerstone of Americana rock. Along with its companion album, American Beauty, released later the same year, it remains a fan favorite and a landmark in the fusion of rock with folk and country traditions.
Yeah, when you mentioned 1970, I was thinking, yeah, I think this is around the time they went in sort of a folkier direction.
Yeah, and this album was released, June 14th, 1970. And the genres are roots rock, folk rock, country rock, and blues rock. And it was released on Warner Brothers Records and produced by Bob Matthews, Betty Cantor, and the Grateful Dead. And there are 8 songs on the album. And side one and side two split pretty evenly, 4 and 4. And so what we like to do is take a pause at the halfway mark. Discuss the album after side one or wherever the halfway point of the album is. And the album opens with Uncle John's Band, and side one ends with New Speedway Boogie. So if you're listening along, which we do encourage you to do, if you want to take a pause at that song to hear the halftime discussion. And we've linked the album to both Spotify and Apple Music, so you can get it on your preferred streaming service. Okay, here is the first song on the album, Uncle John's Band.
Well, the first days are the hardest days. Don't you worry anymore.
All right, and ending side one with New Speedway Boogie. This is about what I was expecting about from this album based on the description.
Yep.
It's that sort of rootsy rock that was sort of popular in the late 60s, early 70s with bands like, Creedence Clearwater Revival and The Band and Crosby, Stills and Nash and Neil Young's solo stuff. That kind of, it's sort of in that sort of aesthetic, I suppose.
Yeah, I do believe so. That aesthetic sort of came about with like the Birds and Buffalo Springfield sort of started that back in the late 60s.
Yeah, and I enjoy it so far. I've always had a sort of an affinity for that sort of Americana music. It's sort of, I wouldn't say it's like the anti-psychedelic music, but it's sort of a nice counterpart. They sort of like complement each other really well.
Yeah, they do. And sometimes even when you blend them, they've actually, there's like psychedelic folk out there, which is kind of, you know, in the same vein in a lot of ways. Yeah, it's, so far I'm enjoying it. It's, I think the only one that sort of had dragged on a little bit for me was High Time. It just seemed a little, I don't know.
Yeah, that one, it was a good song, but yeah, I see what you mean. It's sort of like, it sort of could have ended a little more, it could have been trimmed down a little bit.
Maybe I just need something with a little more energy at the moment. And that song was just kind of, I don't know, dragging. I think a lot of people like that song, probably, especially potheads, probably. But Grateful Dead concerts and potheads and kind of they're pretty synonymous with each other. But that's the only song that actually sort of was like a lulled a little bit for me. But things really picked up with New Speedway Boogie. I thought that was pretty good.
That was pretty good. Yeah. Sort of a slow, their version of like Walla Boogie, sort of like what John Lee Hooker would do, kind of thing.
Please don't dominate the rap jack if you've got nothing new to say. If you please don't back up the jack, this train's got to run today.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know a whole lot about the Grateful Dead, and I don't really know their career trajectory, but I do know, I think like our either, I think it was our second episode, we did their first or second album, which was, the name escapes me right now.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I didn't realize it was our second episode.
Yeah, it was Anthem of the Sun. And that one was a lot more psychedelic. That was like, you know, more of the San Francisco, you know, psychedelic sound. And, you know, it's not that surprising. Like that was in 68. So that was only 2 years before this, but it's not really that surprising that they would go from that to this kind of music. It seems like a natural progression. And then later when we did, I think on American Beauty, from what I remember, it was more like a blend of the two. It was more of a psychedelic sound, but with more of like a country sort of influence. It's sort of more of a blend of the two. Whereas this is definitely like rootsy country rock, almost like Graham Parsons or like the Flying Burrito Brothers.
That's a very good description. Yeah, and even later Bird stuff. It's it doesn't surprise me at all that they sort of kind of went in this direction either, because it's they seemed like very laid back people, and they do laid back music for the most part, and even like their psychedelic stuff was still kind of spacey in the head sort of thing. Maybe it wasn't like as laid back in like the playing or something like that, but it definitely, this is definitely more the relaxed side of things, I think.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. It's but even like I've heard some of their stuff from like the mid 70s and even later 70s, and they did incorporate some more like funk elements in there, like especially on the song Shakedown Street.
Oh yeah.
And so like it, but even that is more of a laid back
version. It
has,
yeah.
Yeah. It has a definite swing to it, to the rhythm. So even when they're, even their songs with that have more energy is sort of in that relaxed sort of loose feel. You know, with this, I think, American Beauty was the follow-up to this.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think after that, they sort of went back to their more bluesy sort of stuff. Every album after his live album, they did a lot of live albums.
They were always touring.
Yes. Yeah, that is true. And they have a policy. They sort of started the whole live bootleg movement, and they allowed people to sort of bring their own recording equipment and record all of their shows. And there is a huge network of Grateful Dead fans. First of all, like Grateful Dead fans are they are not typical rock and roll fan. They tend to travel when the band goes on tour. A lot of them will travel with the band, and if not the whole tour, they will, you know, go with them for a big chunk of the tour. And so it's sort of this community that has developed, and it's cool. You see, like with the advent of the internet, you see all of these communities sort of starting, and people from different places and it's whatever special interests you have and whatever hobby you have, you see these communities developing. But the Grateful Dead sort of had that same thing, but back in the 70s, it was the mindset of, you know, everybody's taking care of each other and that kind of thing. And so it was a real community sort of feel. And part of it was you could take your own recording equipment and, you know, you could record for the show. But they recorded everything from the soundboard. So you would trade back and forth with people, and you would mail tapes back and forth, and it was a real network of people. And the jam bands in the 90s sort of picked that up with, like, there's a real culture of that with like Fish and bands like that. But the Grateful Dead kind of started that in the 70s. There's 60s and 70s.
Yeah, late 60s.
Mostly in the 70s.
Definitely in the 70s, yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that's really cool that they were, like I was saying, it's common now to have that sort of community, like with, if you're a fan of something, to find people on the internet, but they were doing that, you know, 30 years before that was really common. I don't know how or why that started, but it's just, I don't think the band really intended for that to happen. It just sort of happened around them. It's a really, really cool thing.
It could have started with practically any band, but it started, I think, probably, well, somebody figured out that they were always on tour, or several other people, really, you know, big Grateful Dead fans decided, oh, they're constantly on tour, and I guess they're going to be in the next city over the following night. Oh, I might as well go over there and see them then. And, you know, some of them just decided to keep going because they, you know, well, a lot of them, I guess, didn't have much else to do. It probably started organically like that, and it just started snowballing.
Well, that's a lot of it, you know.
Yeah. And that culture then sort of established itself. Yeah. And by the time the '90s came along, said, well, that's already a thing people were doing.
I'll tag along too, and it just
yeah, exactly. Let's get a bus and paint it up and follow the band. Yep.
I mean, look, there are certain substances that were taken in those concerts, and you know, I'm not judging it or anything, but it was I'm sure that helped because you know that it was just this sort of, I think a lot of the time, like a lot of the when we're talking about, like, people often refer to the end of the 60s or the death of the 60s or when the 60s died. And a lot of people attribute it to like December of 69 when the Rolling Stones had the Altamont concert and somebody was stabbed by the Hell's Angels. And a lot of the sort of idealism of the 60s sort of died with that and people got a lot more guarded. But I think the Grateful Dead sort of proved that, you know, you can sort of keep it going. You can, it doesn't have to die, but maybe it just got too big and it got a little too out of hand. But if you keep it small and keep you can keep a community going and keep an idea going.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I've heard people say that, you know, the 60s died at Altamont as well. You know, it would have been an awesome show, but it really, I don't think anybody was in a particularly good mood after that, you know, that show.
No. Well, I mean, when you hire the Hell's Angels to do your security, that's not, that was not a wise choice but lesson learned, I suppose.
Yeah. Hard lesson learned.
Yeah. But getting back to this album, I did manage to find a few pretty interesting facts about the album. It was, I didn't know this, it was written after a drug bust. In 1969, the band was arrested in New Orleans on drug charges. The experience, combined with the stress of constant touring and financial troubles, influenced the Dead to simplify their approach and focus on tight, harmony-driven songs rather than sprawling psychedelic jams.
Interesting. I'm not entirely sure how the two relate, but that's sort of interesting. I don't know.
Well, I think they sort of, you know, sometimes an experience can just sort of shake you out of the haze that you're in, and maybe they just got too far into the jam stuff and they weren't really writing any cohesive songs and they decided, you know, yeah, it could be that. It could just be as simple as, hey, you know, this thing happened and it's just some outside influence had like a paradigm shift for them or something. I don't know. And like we said, sort of not surprising, there was a big influence from Crosby, Stills, and Nash. The band was inspired by the vocal blend of Crosby, Stills, and Nash, who were exploding in popularity at the time. This influence is clear in the rich layered harmonies throughout Working Men's Dead, particularly on Uncle John's Band. And yeah, I can definitely hear the influence of the harmonies, there for sure. The album was, recorded very quickly, and unlike their earlier albums, which were complex and expansive, studio undertakings, Working Man's Dead was recorded in just 9 days at Pacific High Recorders in San Francisco, giving it a raw and natural feel.
8 songs, 9 days. I wonder which one they did twice.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that just happens. I mean, sometimes when a band is
they've been touring and they're familiar with each other, they can come in and just record very quickly. I know the Black Crowes, their second album, they toured like for a year and a half on their first album, Shake Your Moneymaker. And then they took like a week off and then were back in the studio, and their second album took 9 or 8 days. And they just said, and a couple of the songs that are on the album are first takes. They just kind of looked at each other and said, well, probably not going to get much better than that, and just move on to the next one.
Yeah, sometimes that's when a second album isn't like a flop. Like oftentimes, like we were discussing at one point, where it's a, you know, a band will have like, you know, their whole lives to write their first album, and then their second album comes along while we become sort of like a rush job. But if the band is tight enough, you know, after lots of touring and stuff like that, sometimes, yeah, if they actually manage to write songs, then the songs come out quite well, very quickly, because the band just knows what they're doing at that point.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's the same case here. It's like they, as much as they toured, I know, and they didn't really have a whole lot of lineup changes, and so they're very familiar with each other, toured a lot. So I don't know about all of their albums, but I'm sure like this one obviously benefits from that sort of, and you can hear that it's like, I'm sure it's mostly live. There may have been some overdubs of like, maybe, you know, let's add a part here and there, but the core performance is, you know,
off the floor,
Yeah. Interesting, I did hear this is Jerry Garcia's pedal steel guitar. Garcia played pedal steel guitar on Direwolf and High Time, showcasing his growing interest in country music. Around the same time, he was playing pedal steel with New Raiders of the Purple Sage, another side project that he had. And yeah, pedal steel is definitely different than playing guitar. It's a whole other instrument.
It really is. It's related to the guitar through things like the dobro and the lap steel, and the pedal steel basically takes that, lifts it up, and then adds pedals for string bending.
Yeah, and that's a different tuning, and yeah.
Yeah, you can use a similar tuning. Well, there's a lot more strings usually. I mean, I've seen many different types, but pedal steels became real, I guess it was around the 1950s with like Hawaiian music was like taking off, and it was sort of like mixed in with the country sound of the 50s as well. And it just kind of stuck around. And that's the sort of the music that influenced a lot of rock bands even in the late 60s and into the 70s. If they ever decided to, you know, play it's definitely a different animal than playing blues slide, which usually is on a regular guitar, although you can definitely do it on a lap steel. But yeah, a lot of like steel guitars in general have got this real glassy sound to it. It's a very clean sound, and you could barely even hear like the ridges in the strings or anything like that. It's just so smooth. Yeah, it's just really, really smooth, really, really glossy, really, but it doesn't sound like, you know, it's a good sound to mix in with something so long as it's not overproduced, because you know, you could very easily get everything too glossy, and then just kind of, you know, loses a little bit of loses all of its texture, and you kind of want texture in other areas to sort of counteract the really ultra clean sound that's kind of piercing. It's a very biting sound too. It really makes its way to the forefront of your mix very easily.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
And the album was it was a turning point. It was their commercial breakthrough. The album was a turning point for the Dead's career. Uncle John's Band and Casey Jones received significant FM radio airplay, helping the group reach a wider audience and proving that they could balance accessibility with their experimental roots. And I think their biggest hit was that song Touch of Grey in like 1990 or something like that. But the other song that I, before I really knew anything about the Grateful Dead, I knew that song. But the other song that I knew was Casey Jones.
Yeah, and Casey Jones, I think up to definitely around this point was their biggest hit. Well, it was a hit for a band that didn't necessarily write hit songs. That one was the one that actually made radio play.
Yes, and, exactly.
Got them. I mean, the fact that it's about a guy high on cocaine, it's amazing that it got the radio play it did at the time that it did.
Yeah, that's true. Because it, well, it was FM radio. So, you know, yeah.
Yes, FM radio would have picked up on it a lot more than, but the FM radio was probably playing their other stuff too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I was going to say that was the time when the DJs were allowed to pick what they were going to play. So there was not as many, there was more freedom to get away with things.
Things. People seem to get away with certain things a little bit more nowadays, but as far as the freedom to select the things that you were going to play, it was way better back then.
100%. It absolutely was. There was less people, I guess, were, well, like the FCC and like organizations like that were a little more uptight, but I think they had less of a grip on radio, especially like FM radio. I think they were more concerned about what was happening on TV at this time.
That's probably true, but they did have concern over things on the radio too. And especially it came to a head in the 80s, but there was definitely some tense moments throughout the 60s and 70s and certainly the 50s.
Yes, there were. But that's another topic for another show. I guess we'll get back into the album. Second side starts with the song Cumberland Blues.
We'll now take a few seconds before we begin side two. Thank you. Here's side two.
Ending the album with Casey Jones. I enjoyed this album quite a bit. I like the sort of more rootsy side of the Grateful Dead. It was fun to listen to, and yeah, there was some, I think the second side was a little more interesting. Overall, I think the album was pretty well done.
I gotta say, the album version of Casey Jones is way better than the radio version. There's a lot more going on. Like, they didn't edit out the guitar solos, and it's got a more interesting ending. It doesn't just fade out.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something they used to do quite a bit I don't think they do it so much anymore because I think a lot of music is recorded for radio, but they, it's unfortunate that they did sort of the radio edits back in the day. But yeah, you're right. The I was noticing that too. The album version is, I don't know. I could be, maybe I'm misremembering the radio version, but I think the album version is a little better mixed. It feels a little more, It feels like a little more lively. There's maybe a little more reverb or something. I don't know. It feels elevated a little more or something. I'm not sure.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's, yeah, I think that also added to it. It just, everything felt a little more present, and it was just well mixed. And again, the things that were going on that were cut out of the other version, it was just a lot better, and the song was better for it.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think the album version obviously is their vision for what the song is meant to be, and that sort of comes through a lot clearer. And yeah, I mean, I think the album overall is really well done. And so I guess that brings us to the question is, what would be your three highlights on the album?
My three favorites on the album. I don't usually wind up doing this when I, pick three songs, but as I'm going through the album, I sort of pick them as I'm going along. And I don't usually wind up having to kick ones off because of other songs. But I've had to do that. Yeah, I'm going to have to go with New Speedway Boogie. Ooh, what was better? I think I like Cumberland Blues. There's a lot of good guitar in that. And Casey Jones is just, I was surprised how much I liked that song, hearing it properly. I mean, I always kind of liked the song, but it's just a better song now.
Yeah, I agree. I think I would probably go with New Speedway Boogie and Cumberland Blues as well. Casey Jones, that version of Casey Jones is great, but I think I would probably go with Easy Wind. I really like that one as well. I think those are probably my choices.
That's another really good one. I had to kick it out of its contention just because of Casey Jones.
So I guess that brings us to the question is, would you listen to this album again?
Oh yeah, I'd listen to this again.
Yeah, I would too. I mean, I think it's a great album, and I'm sort of becoming more of a fan of the Grateful Dead. I think I never disliked them, but I definitely want to get more into their stuff.
Yeah, they sort of flew outside my radar.
But I guess we'll end the episode there. And thank you so much for listening if you made it this far. We would love to hear from you. If you want to check out the website, go to polyphonicpress.com and you can get all the past episodes there. And go to the contact page. It's just right there in the top menu. So go to contact and drop us a line, and maybe we'll read one of your messages on one of these episodes. And definitely, if you're interested, you can check out the Patreon. Go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress. Lots of cool stuff there, too. You can get these episodes the day before they go live. And you can pick an album for us to review and even get a shout out during these episodes. And I think that just about does it. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.